It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why Wisconsin can be a tough state to vote in if you're a college student. First, so far in 2020, we've had the coronavirus and stay-at-home orders, furloughs, job losses, canceled events, shortages of toilet paper and hand sanitizer. The list goes on. On top of COVID-19, there's been the death of George Floyd and subsequent protests, looting and violence, uncivil conversation. And remember the impeachment of President Trump? That dragged into 2020 as well. And don't forget about the murder hornets. So maybe it's not surprising that Americans are feeling pretty down this year. A new survey shows that just 14% describe themselves as very happy. That's the lowest level in nearly 50 years. And half say they feel isolated at least some of the time. 2 years ago, only 23% said that. So why are we feeling this way and what can we do about it? Sonia Lubomirsky is a distinguished professor and vice chair of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She's also the author of The Myth of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does, and also The How of Happiness, A New Approach to Getting the Life You Want. Sonia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, looking at the news so far this year, Sonia, was it any surprise to you to see this survey showing a spike in unhappiness?
It was a surprise, actually. I mean, yes, if you look at the news, it sounds like we should all be terribly unhappy, but there have been a lot of data sets coming out, and this is the first one that I've seen a drop in happiness. The other data that I've seen coming out sort of from different samples is showing either no difference or even a slight increase. So there you go.
Was this report an outlier, do you think, or did the timing happen to catch a different trend?
You know, it's really hard to say because every survey is different. It's going to have a different sort of, you know, limitations or strengths. It's going to have different samples, different, as you say, different time periods. Then this was late in May, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. That was when this one came out.
Right. I was just looking at a data set before you called me of about 10 to 20,000 people that were taking mood and depression surveys, and they followed them from January to June, both in 2019 and in 2020. And actually, by May, June of 2020, people are no less happy or no more depressed and actually even a little bit better off in 2020. So that's another data set that's showing different results. So it's really, really hard to say. There's nothing wrong necessarily with any of these studies. They're all kind of giving you a slice of the picture, but it's sort of hard to interpret when they're giving different results.
Well, and it can be hard to draw a straight line, and I think some of your writing in the past has found this, a straight line between what's going on in the world and what's going on in our own minds when it comes to happiness. Bad times may make us less happy and may lead us to rethink, you know, what is valuable in life, what does make us happy.
That's exactly right. So sort of our criteria or a threshold for what you know, gets us to say we're happy might change. My collaborators and I actually have some data ourselves where we looked at the same group of people. This survey, I believe, was different groups of people each time. By the way, there could be self-selection biases, right? So maybe if you're particularly unhappy, you're more likely to say yes to doing the survey, right? So that's another issue with surveys. So we have some data where we followed the same individuals across time, two different samples, and we found that people felt about the same in happiness, and actually a little bit less lonely in one of the samples. And so we thought that doesn't make sense, right? Like we're not able to interact with our friends and family members or even strangers. And how can that make us feel a little bit less lonely? But of course, people, we're all human and we respond in different ways. And there's a sense of sort of coming together and bonding over disaster. There's a sense of like, I'm going to try to Zoom with all my high school friends now and reconnect virtually. So, you know, the way we respond, of course, really, really matters.
Sonia Lubomirsky is with us, professor of psychology and happiness researcher at the University of California, Riverside. We're talking about happiness in a time of some tough news around the country. So it's hard to measure our aggregate happiness, it sounds like, Sonia, but there's some good news, and you've done a lot of work on this. There's a lot we can do when we reevaluate our own happiness. What are some basic tips you might have for people who do feel overwhelmed by the news? What kind of things can we do to refocus and find some happiness?
Sure. Great question. I should mention that about a third, maybe less, but often two-thirds of people are really resilient, but maybe a third are not so much and actually are having a lot of – are really suffering. So for those who are not doing so well, lots and lots of strategies and approaches one can take to maintain happiness or to increase happiness. My own and my colleagues' research focus on two such strategies. One has to do with gratitude, and one has to do with kindness. And both are really, really relevant today, right? So gratitude is basically an antidote to sort of unhappiness. It's sort of focusing on the good things in your life as opposed to focusing on the negative things. Doesn't mean that you don't try to solve problems, but also you sort of think about the silver lining as well. And that's been shown to increase happiness. And then the other one is kindness and sort of supporting other people and reaching out and helping others. Lots and lots of examples during the pandemic of people reaching out and helping their you know, neighbors, their kids' teachers, or, you know, older people, more vulnerable people. So, but it turns out not only do you make other people happier by helping them, but you also make yourself happier or less sad or less anxious.
Let's talk about gratitude a little bit. I think we all think of gratitude as a pretty good thing to have. Is there a way we can, I don't know, operationalize a little bit to make sure we make time and do some practice of gratitude in our daily lives?
Right. It's gratitude is something that you can do. It doesn't have to take a lot of time, right? It can just be throughout the day. You know, whenever you have a negative thought, you might sort of turn your attention to something good in your life. Also, I think a very powerful way to express gratitude is directly to people in your life, because often it is about a person in your life. Maybe it's your mom, maybe it's your best friend, maybe it's a former mentor or teacher who you might write a letter to, an email, a phone call, and express your gratitude for them supporting you. And that really strengthens your connection to that person, makes you feel like the world is a better place, you know, because it has people in it that love you and that help care for you.
On a really basic level, what do we mean by happiness? It could mean, you know, skipping along a field of flowers. It could be a basic sense of contentment. How do we even define happiness in the first place?
It's a great question. I like to define happiness the way that researchers do, which is that happiness has two components. And I like to think of these components as being happy in your life and being happy with your life. So being happy in your life is basically having, you know, experiencing fairly frequent positive emotions, you know, whether it's enthusiasm or tranquility or curiosity or pride or joy. People happy experience more positive emotions. They're more happy in their life, but you're also more happy with your life, which is having a sense that your life is good, that you're progressing towards your life's goals, that you're satisfied with your life. So really those two components make up happiness.
And is that something we measure when we survey people, or do we just, you know, if I get surveyed in a lot of these things, do people just ask me, am I happy? And I kind of throw my own definition in there.
Well, yes, you do. I mean, people do tend to use their own definitions. We, you know, subjective self-report measures of happiness are really the only thing that we have. There's no thermometer for happiness. So all we can really do is ask people how happy they are. But researchers use, you know, different types of measures. I mean, the kind of large-scale surveys that you're talking about, you often will just have one item, like how happy are you overall or how satisfied you are with your life overall. But we like to, if we have the resources and the time to ask more specific questions about sort of how often do you experience positive emotions, you know, how satisfied are you with your life, you know, asked in five different ways. And that creates a more reliable and valid measure. But you're absolutely right that people do have sort of bring their own definition to mind. I mean, I like to say that most of us, the far majority of us, sort of know whether we're happy or not. You know, it's something that you know, we know it when we see it. So I don't think it's very hard question to answer.
We're talking about happiness in America. One survey shows a growth in unhappiness this year. Others, maybe we're holding steady, but we're talking about what can make us happy, how we can give ourselves a boost if we're not feeling happy these days. Sonia Lubomirsky is with us, psychology professor at the University of California, Riverside. She studies happiness. She's written a lot of books about it. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How would you describe your overall level of happiness? Has 2020 been difficult for you? Has it made you less happy? Are there things you reach for in those times to make you more happy? Have you rethought the things that are valuable in your daily life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about happiness. A new survey from the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago says only 14% of Americans say they're very happy. That would be the lowest level in 48 years. But our guest says other surveys show maybe different trends. Sonia Lubomirsky is helping us understand happiness, what it means, and how we can find it. She's a distinguished professor and vice chair of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She's the author of multiple books on happiness, including The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How would you describe your overall level of happiness? Has it been tough to be happy given all the news of 2020? Are there things you turn to, big or little, in your daily life, friends, family, gratitude, you name it, a hobby, that make you happy when you need it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. Well, while I was listening to you, I was doing a very hard crossword puzzle, and it occurred to me that I am really very happy that Mr. Gutenberg invented the press. I learned to read at age 3. I have never stopped reading. I am totally addicted to the printed word. It is just, I can't even contemplate what life would be like. And it was for centuries and centuries without reading material. I want to read.
Nancy, thank you so much. So, Sonia, Nancy has found the daily activity, it sounds like, that makes her really happy, reading crossword puzzles, that sort of thing. How important is that, just figuring out the little things maybe that make us happy and then making sure we make time for them?
Yeah. I think this is really beautiful, that what Nancy's demonstrating is the importance of gratitude, right? That most of us take for granted that we can read and the printed word exists. But also, you know, any kind of activity that can really like draw our attention, engage us, you know, gives us what's called flow, which is when we're so absorbed and engaged in what we're doing that we really can savor, is going to contribute to happiness. For many, many people, it's reading. For other people, it might be listening to music or creating music. It might be doing some kind of physical activity or really engaging in work or other kinds of hobbies, cooking, gardening. So I think having an activity that you really love and that really absorbs your attention is important and can contribute to a lot of happiness.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Sonia, I want to ask you about something I think we've talked to you on the show about in the past, and it's in the subtitle of one of your books. Things that we think are going to make us happy, but don't. What are some of those?
So the things that make us that we think will make us happy or don't are really the kind of the circumstantial changes of our lives that we think are kind of the secret to happiness. So many of us believe that, you know, if only my life would change in X, Y, or Z ways, then I'll be happy. Like when it's like we're waiting for happiness. When I have a baby, then I'll be happy. When I get that job that I want, then I'll be happy. When I move to that city I've always wanted to live in, then I'll be happy. When I lose that weight, then I'll be happy. Now, what the fact is that those kinds of life changes do make people happier, but they don't make us as happy or for as long as we think they will. Because, you know, guess what? The same person in the new job or in the new relationship or after you lose weight, you're still the same person. And so we tend to adapt. It's called hedonic adaptation. And then we tend to go back right to our baseline. Now, it doesn't mean that if our situation is bad, we shouldn't change it, because that can really, really improve our happiness. But a lot of life changes we sort of think are the solution to all of our problems, but they're really not.
How do we break out of that mindset of thinking, once I hit that milestone, then I'll be happy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just important to understand that it's not necessarily going to make you happier forever, and to really understand what it is that does make people happy. And that is really what kind of how we behave and how we think in our daily lives. So yes, like if you get that new job and that new job affects how you sort of what you're thinking and doing throughout the day, that gives you a lot of challenge and growth and variety and opportunities to meet new people, then that could really make you happy. But if that new job or that new house or whatever that changes is gonna be something that's gonna sort of make you happy temporarily, but then you sort of go back to baseline because it's not gonna really change your life in a way that's gonna be, I guess that's not gonna lead to daily changes, then it's not gonna make you happy forever. So I think the first step is really to sort of understand that a lot of things don't make you happy forever, and then to really change yourself in a way that does. And so, for example, we were talking about helping others before, or feeling grateful for what you have, and those are that's the kind of mindset that can actually improve your happiness sort of on a regular basis.
Sonia Lubomirsky is with us talking about happiness, how we can find it, what are some of the things that can boost our happiness, what are some of the things that get in the way. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that you turn to, or maybe something you've built into your daily life that helps you become or stay happy? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sonia, I read something that you had written about introverts, and this is interesting to me as an introvert, that sometimes the best way for an introvert to be happy is to act like an extrovert.
Yes. I mean, that really surprised me as well. So there's a large and robust correlation between extroversion and happiness. So extroverts are happier. Now, I'm a true believer that there's lots of benefits to being, I mean, I am an extrovert, but I have lots of good friends and family members that are introverts, and there's certainly lots of benefits to being an introvert and to really be reflecting and thinking as opposed to just talking all the time like us extroverts do. But we did a study where we asked people for a week to act more extroverted than you normally do, and then for the next week to act more introverted than you normally do, and vice versa. And we found huge effects. So everyone, including the introverts, during the week that they were asked to act more extroverted, felt happier, more positive emotions, more meaning, more flow. And during the introvert week, they felt less happy. So we were surprised at that. I mean, we thought that the introverts would become sort of fatigued, right, with being more social.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kevin is with us in West Central Wisconsin. Kevin, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Kevin?
I'm real fortunate to be living in West Central Wisconsin. It's a beautiful area, and we're all working together against this coronavirus, and it seems to be working. We're staying healthy, so I'm very happy for that.
Kevin, keep staying healthy. Thank you so much for calling. Two things Kevin noted there. He loves the scenery, the landscape, and he loves his feeling of community there. Can you talk a little bit about both of those, Sonia?
Yes, absolutely. Well, community is so important. Feeling like you belong is super important to happiness and just sort of living a fulfilling life. Psychologists call this the need to belong. We all feel like we need to belong somewhere, and it could be our family, it could be our community, it could be, you know, other kinds of groups and organizations. In terms of nature, really interesting research showing that when we're in nature, we feel more relaxed. It's kind of like when we're in this, I mean, I love cities myself. I'm a very urban person, but research shows that when we're in an urban environment, all of those urban sights and sounds, like the billboards and the noise, they kind of take our attention in a way that makes us just stressed out and sort of not, it's hard to relax. And so our mood is not as good. And so studies show that just being, spending more time in nature, even having something on your wall that's a nature scene, makes people a little bit happier, lifts their mood. So I kind of love those findings.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Arlene now in Two Creeks. Arlene, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to share that I had an experience. I became diabetic and had to lose about roughly 100 to 150 pounds. I managed to do that within 2 years, and not realizing that this change did not only help me take accountability for my actions on the consequences of everything that I did to get to that point where I was very sick. and I had other issues like thyroid issues and things like that, liver issues, and taking control over my health really helped me. I didn't realize that it would make me happy to have all that responsibility and acknowledging that I had to do these things for my health and my life in the future and what kind of life I wanted to have.
Arlene, I want to jump in because we just have a couple minutes left. But Sonia, it sounds like Arlene was happy not just because she had, you know, lost the weight and became healthier, but because she had focused in on changing her daily routine and her habits.
Yes, I mean, I think the first step, you know, this may sound like a cliche. The first step is really to sort of, to have some perspective, to think about your life and what makes you happy and what makes you unhappy, where you have control over, what you can change. That's the first step. And the second step is to take kind of those baby steps towards that change. It sounds like that's what Arlene did.
Thank you so much for that call, Arlene. Mm-hmm. In just our last minute or so, Sonia, can you leave us a bit of advice just to kind of monitor our happiness, see where we are, and then take steps to fix it?
Sure. Well, I don't think one should monitor their happiness too much because then you kind of get into the, am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? It could actually might make you feel less happy. Mm. But I think just like with anything, your weight or the stock market, you don't want to monitor too much, but once in a while, it could be once a month, you know, once every few months. I think it is important to monitor something and measure it, because if you can't measure something, you can't really change it, right? You need to sort of know where you are to be able to know whether you're improving.
Sonia, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you in Wisconsin. Thank you.
Sonia Lubomirsky has been with us. She's a distinguished professor and vice chair of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She's written multiple books on happiness, including The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. We talked to her about recent surveys on happiness, the challenges facing us with tough news out there, and what we can do to get and stay happy. Still time for you to share your own thoughts, your experiences, maybe your own advice over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the obstacles for college students in Wisconsin to be able to vote. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a federal appeals court has reinstated a Wisconsin law that limits early voting and imposes a stricter residency requirement to vote. We'll look at yesterday's ruling and what it means for upcoming elections. First, also related to voting, a report from Wisconsin Watch shows the state's voter ID laws for college students have made the process difficult, and it's more confusing when students aren't on campus because of the COVID-19 outbreak. Dee Hall is managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. She recently talked to WPR host Keely Baltina.
How many college students actually vote here in Wisconsin?
Well, like most places, college voters are not the most vigorous voters around. We have about 340,000 college students in Wisconsin, ranging from UW-Madison to technical colleges and schools. And they make up 6.9% of the electorate. The issue with young voters is that they often vote at a fraction of the rate of older ones. Nationally, for example, voters ages 18 to 25 voted at about a 36% turnout rate compared to like 66% for people 60 and older. So they're clearly, it's a large demographic group, but it's one that really hasn't shown its political power fully yet.
Although at 6.9%, that can be significant considering Wisconsin has this reputation for close elections.
Yes, that's the key here, because many of our statewide races are decided by 1% or so. And for example, Donald Trump won the state of Wisconsin in 2016 by right around 1%, or about 23,000. So you can see how an infusion of college voters could really make a difference one way or the other in a race.
Does college student voting benefit one political party over the other?
Well, generally speaking, younger voters tend to skew Democratic. And so about 60% of the people, of voters 18 to 25 nationwide would call themselves Democrats. There was a Tufts University study that found that counties in Wisconsin's college students, they went for Evers more significantly than counties without college students who voted for Governor Scott Walker. And of course, Evers won. So, you know, it can be a very decisive force when the college voters get together and vote.
One person in this article from Wisconsin Watch says that the voter ID requirements seem purposely designed to make it hard for students in Wisconsin to vote. Can we prove that?
Well, there have been studies in other places that talk about that. In North Carolina, for example, even after they got rid of their photo ID requirement, students and younger voters still had a hard time complying. So it's generally recognized that these kinds of requirements, photo ID requirements, do tend to depress votes among Democrats, among people of color, and among younger voters who are not as familiar, let's say, with the voting system.
How do we know about Wisconsin's voter ID requirements and how those affect a student's ability to vote, specifically in April's election?
So the issue with college student voters in April was compounded. You've got the issue of photo ID, which we talked about, which is difficult for college students to comply with. There are additional requirements for students to prove their identity and their residence that are beyond what you or I, non-students, would have to prove. For example, we're the only state in the country that requires a college student who wants to use a college ID with the college address on it, or to say that that person's in college, they have to get a proof of enrollment form from their university. In addition, most of the IDs that are issued by UW campuses are not compliant with the voter ID law, the photo ID law. So, for example, we have 13 four-year UW campuses. Only four of them issue an ID to students that is compliant with the law. So those campuses then have to issue a separate ID to students who don't always know that they need a separate ID in order for them to use that college identification to vote. So those are some of the barriers that have been existing since the law was put in place in 2015, after a long court battle that went on for years. Beyond that, of course, we had the pandemic. So students found out with very short notice that they were not going to be on campus if they live away from home. They were not going to be on campus anywhere in the state of Wisconsin at the April 7th election. So some of them, had to re-register at their permanent home. Those who stayed in Madison had to decide, do I still want to vote in person, for example, or do I try to figure out this absentee balloting system? So we don't have any particular numbers about how much college voting was suppressed, but we did speak with people who were working in this area in voter registration, who said that it was just a lot of confusion and people were mostly just concerned about getting back to their homes safely, and the election was somewhat of a secondary matter for them.
Dee Hall is managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. We're talking about a piece about the challenges that college students in Wisconsin face when they want to vote and how the pandemic affects that. This is the Ideas Network. Dee, the reporter on this story highlights a student named Peter German. What was his experience in the recent election? It seems like it's a pretty good example of that confusion you were talking about.
Yeah, so Kayla Hewn was one of my students in our spring class where we were examining issues surrounding Wisconsin's upcoming election. And she happened to go out to the polls in February, the spring primary in February, and she luckily ran across Peter German, who was a student who was just determined to vote. He had voted every election that he was eligible to vote for, so he was at that time a freshman from West Bend here at UW-Madison. He'd been running from building to building trying to cast his ballot. So he had tried to register at the Madison City Clerk's office the day before the election. In-person registration was not available. He didn't have the right ID. He didn't have the other documents we talked about, the proof of enrollment documents. And so on election day, he again had to crisscross across campus to finally get the student voter card, which he needed to be able to cast a ballot from his Madison address, his dorm address. He is just illustrative of the fact that Wisconsin is one of the most difficult places for college students to vote. Then after the pandemic, he, like most people, left campus, went back to their home cities, and he had a rough go of the absentee balloting system, which, as has been widely reported, was really chaotic. And he ran into trouble then too in April when he tried to, he was successful in voting, and he was able to vote absentee, but there were a lot of bumps on the road to that result.
There are lawsuits pending over Wisconsin's student voter ID laws. What do advocates challenge here?
Well, there are three different lawsuits, and they're actually all challenging, they're all federal lawsuits, and so they are challenging these requirements under the U.S. Constitution. So the arguments, for example, one of them raises the equal protection due process claim, which is people should be equally protected under the law regardless of your age or your status. For example, another one specifically mentions the amendment that gave 18-year-olds the vote and that this is violating that amendment. And generally speaking, the arguments are that, you know, you are requiring college students to do something that other voters don't have to do, and therefore you're violating their right to vote.
Students haven't been on campuses here in Wisconsin, many of them for months. How could what Wisconsin Watch reports here affect future voting? And yes, I'm looking ahead to the November election.
Right. I think some of the same issues that we saw in April are probably going to be here in November. I know at the UW-Madison, for example, that they're suspending in-person instruction after the Thanksgiving break because of the concern that the coronavirus will be so strong that it will be unsafe for our people to meet together after that break. So there is a concern about a resurgence in the virus in Wisconsin and elsewhere. As a result, students may not know exactly where they're going to be on November 3rd. And if you don't know where you're going to be living, it makes it more difficult for you. You have to change your registration address. You have to register in the place where you're living as opposed to maybe Madison, where you may have voted, or vice versa. You're a student at UW-Milwaukee, but your home is in Green Bay. You know, do you register to vote in Milwaukee and file an absentee ballot because you're not physically going to be in Milwaukee? Or do you re-register and change your state voter registration to make it Green Bay with the idea that then at some point you're going to have to change it back to Milwaukee when you go back to school? So I think they're facing a somewhat different hurdle in the sense that unlike most of us who stay put living where we live, students change addresses throughout the year, and they have a legal right to vote at either place, at the place, their hometown or their school. But it does require efforts on their part to change those addresses and then to, again, prove the address where they are staying at the time of the election.
Dee, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Dee Hall, managing editor of Wisconsin Watch and co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee talked to WPR host Keely Baltina about a story on barriers to voting for college students here in Wisconsin. You can read the full article at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll find out what yesterday's federal court ruling means for early voting and other election provisions here in the state. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Reggie, the real critic, is back for some movie talk with a serious theme. Reggie shares some great movies that tackle issues of race in the United States. Now, early voting in Wisconsin will be limited to 2 weeks before an election, and you'll have to have lived in the state for 28 days before casting your ballot. Those were laws that were struck down by a U.S. district judge in 2016. A federal appeals court panel reinstated those portions yesterday. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who's running for Congress this fall as a Republican, called the ruling, quote, a win for fair elections. He said it also puts communities on more equal footing with regard to early in-person voting. State Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler said the decision is, quote, an outrageous assault on our democracy. The ruling comes just over 4 months before the presidential election and as officials figure out how to hold that election amid the coronavirus. Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, good to have you back with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today.
Well, this was a long time coming. Can you sum up the history of what led us here, Patrick?
Yeah, it is very unusual in how long this case took. The laws were challenged a number of years ago, and in 2016, a federal judge based in Madison, it was a very big lawsuit challenging more than a dozen state laws on elections. And the judge ruled in favor of them in some ways and against them in other ways. That was appealed, and arguments were heard on the appeal in February of 2017. And then everything went dark until yesterday. Normally, appeals cases like this take 6 to 8 months, maybe a little longer for a more complex case like this. But really, there's been no explanation why it took the court 3 years to issue its decision.
And this is an appeals court. It has a bunch of judges, but this was a panel decision of three, which is a thing they do a lot. And this was unanimous amongst the three of them, right, this decision?
That's right. Three longtime judges appointed by Republican presidents unanimously issued a 27-page decision after all this time, primarily ruling on behalf of the state laws, upholding the state laws. There are a couple of areas where they did rule in favor of the plaintiffs, but primarily it was a setback for the liberal groups that brought the lawsuits that had expanded early voting and changed some other election laws.
All right, there's a lot of bits and pieces here. Let's take them one at a time now. Early voting, what was the limit in this law that now, after this long-awaited decision, is going to be in place?
Yeah, this is the most significant part of the decision, I would say. The Republican lawmakers had put a limit in law on early voting to about 2 weeks, and that got struck down. They actually passed new limits that were similar, of a few differences. That got struck down. This court has put those back in place. So early voting in person will be kept to about 2 weeks. That's a big change for places like Madison and Milwaukee, which had offered many weeks of early voting while the previous decision had been in place. And so, I don't know how much of an immediate effect we'll see on that, given that so many voters have turned toward absentee voting because of coronavirus. But when things go back to usual and people are more likely to vote at the polls and more likely to vote early in person, we could see a significant effect on things like races for governor or state Supreme Court.
That's an important distinction you make. Absentee voting is voting early, in effect, but it's not what we're talking about. We talk about early voting. This is early in-person voting that's affected by this decision, right?
Yes. Communities in Wisconsin offer that in their city halls or their clerk's office. And some places like Madison and Milwaukee have remote locations. Madison has perhaps the most robust early voting, has it at every library and many places on college campuses. They'll continue to be able to have multiple locations, but they'll only be able to do it for 2 weeks rather than for the many weeks that they have in the past.
And can you talk about some of the back and forth, the arguments over this that both sides have had of, you know, local control versus keeping things even for everybody?
Yes. Yeah, so the Republicans put this in place because they said it wasn't fair that places like Milwaukee and Madison had this very extensive early voting and more rural places had more limited early voting because they have fewer staff members and didn't have the budgets that would allow them to have as full of early voting. The counter argument from Democrats and city officials in big places is that they have a lot more voters. There's more distance. The towns are geographically bigger. And so that, you know, City Hall, while centrally located, might not be easy to get to if you live in the outer reaches of the city. The challengers who had challenged that law, part of their argument was that there were many different changes to election laws over the years that were affecting African Americans, Latino voters in ways that they had more impacts than white voters did, and that taken together, these things violated their voting rights. The lower court agreed. The higher court said that what Republican lawmakers were trying to do was win elections. They weren't concerned about the race of people's voting, the race of the people who were voting. They were concerned about getting more Republican votes than Democratic votes. And they said that as long as their motivation was on the political part of the spectrum, that they were allowed to put these changes in place.
Yeah, that was an interesting point. And this has gone up to the Supreme Court, this argument. You can make election changes to favor one party or another as long as it's not specifically favoring people based on racial status.
Yeah, that's exactly what the court said yesterday.
Talking to Patrick Marley, state politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at an appeals court ruling, a long-awaited ruling on election laws here in the state. As you said, Patrick, the early voting part of this was the big part. Not the only thing, though. This residency requirement change seems like more of a subtle point. What changes here?
Yes, and I would say that's actually a significant change, too. Wisconsin had required that you be a resident at your address for 10 days before an election. The Republicans had expanded that to 28 days, and the lower court had struck that down. This higher court put that up. So if you move in the month before an election, you will have to vote from your previous address. If you move from another state into Wisconsin, you wouldn't be able to vote for most offices in Wisconsin. You would have to cast an absentee ballot from the state you had come from. And if you move, you know, within your city or from one part of Wisconsin to another, again, you would have to vote from your previous address if it's fewer than 28 days before an election. So that, you know, for president or something like that, it may not matter. But for if, you know, maybe in one of the districts there was a hotly contested congressional race and in the other there isn't, you'd have to be voting absentee from the old address.
Democrats, the challengers here did wind up getting a couple things they wanted. What did the court agree with them on?
So one aspect was there was a provision that Republicans had put in place that would say that the dorm lists that are given to polling places, you know, polling places have the addresses of voters so that when you check in, they can ensure that you're at the correct address. They wanted that to include citizen information because obviously there's some international students at Madison and other colleges. The appeals court said they wouldn't go for that, that would violate student privacy laws that have been put in place by Congress. And so those voting lists will look the same as all of the other residence lists that they have.
Is there any thought that, you know, this is a three-judge panel, any thought that this could be taken now to the whole court or might be challenged, I don't know, up to the Supreme Court, or is this it as far as we know?
So I haven't heard from either side if there's going to be an attempt to pursue this case further, but those are the two options if someone were to try to appeal. They can try to get the entire Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to take it up and review the panel's decision, or they can go to the Supreme Court. Either is a bit of a long shot. It may be easier to get the entire appeals court to hear the case, but you know the Supreme Court hears a very small number of cases at any given time. Now, we did just have the U.S. Supreme Court rule on Wisconsin's election laws as part of the challenge to what the terms of the April 7 Supreme Court race were, so perhaps it'll get there, but so far nobody said that they're going to appeal.
And Patrick, with the election year and COVID-19, a lot of the hot stories in how we vote have been, you know, do we mail absentee ballot applications to a lot of people? What are deadlines for absentee ballots? None of this is affected, if I'm reading it correctly, in this court decision. Do I have that right?
That's right. For the most part, you know, all of this litigation preceded by years, coronavirus. And so that the issue of the pandemic is not addressed in the decision, nor was it addressed in arguments or any of the briefs that had been filed. This decision from yesterday really doesn't get into absentee voting. Now, as your previous guest was talking about, there's a lot of litigation over how this fall's elections will occur and what the rules should be. You know, the federal judge that is hearing those cases will be bound by this decision that came out yesterday, even though it travels a little separately. And so, you know, he may be seeing this message from the appeals court that it's reluctant to put any limits on or to change Wisconsin's election laws. So that will be hovering in the background of these other cases. But this decision from yesterday does not directly address how we run elections during the coronavirus pandemic.
And very briefly, Patrick, now that they pulled this one out of the filing cabinet, is there another big election story or case you're watching for next?
I mean, there are these four cases that are before Judge William Conley in Madison. We expect to see a decision in those cases. They're essentially being treated as one case, even though there's lots of lawsuits with lots of parties. We expect a decision by that at the end of August. They're not seeking changes for the August primary, but they are for the November election. And so, you know, expect a lot of activity there, expect appeals there. the rules as to what exactly will be in place for November could change significantly between.
And I will leave it there. Thanks to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, bringing us up to date on a big, long-awaited court ruling from an appeals court on Wisconsin's election laws. If you don't mind a little bit of media insider news, here's a thing that almost flew under my radar until my wife sent a social media post. Tomorrow marks the 7th anniversary of this show. On July 1st of 2013, Veronica Rickard and I hosted the first daily version of Central Time. We had done a few pilot broadcasts in June of that year to iron out some of the wrinkles. And there were a few wrinkles. Then on the 1st, we hopped on the air for the daily run of the show. And it's been running ever since then. We're not always real good at remembering anniversaries here on the show, though. In years past, I actually haven't thought about the dates until like August or so. And we don't have any actual celebration in place this time around. So how about a quick thank you to all the people here at Wisconsin Public Radio over the years who have produced, engineered, consulted, co-hosted, or fill-in hosted and appeared on the show over this last run of 7 years, to our literally thousands of guests that we've talked to on the air. And of course, thanks to you for listening and calling in. There wouldn't be really any reason to do the show if you didn't do those things. So thank you, and here's to 7 more years of Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.